First John chapter 2. Verse 15 to 17. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. Let's pray. So, Father, I was thinking there's no reason for me to walk up here. No reason at all. I'm just as sinful as anyone here has ever been before you. Just as without grace as anyone here has ever been before you. Just as much have I known what it is to be without knowledge and wisdom. And the question is, why should I gain anything? Why should I even be let in the room? And Lord, it is true, yet it is true that as we were talking earlier, you use people, you want to use people, you want to. And think of what Paul said of the lost, that they're useless. And Onesimus was once useless, and now he was useful to Philemon. And so, Lord, and we think of Peter, he says that if these qualities are yours and they're increasing, they render you neither useless. So, Lord, no adequacy in me. No help in me, but oh Lord, help me, I pray. Lord, empower me this morning. Fall upon me this morning, Lord, with the Holy Spirit. Clothe me, Lord, like it says in Luke 24, with power from on high. Have the kingdom among us, I pray, in word and in power. Lord, you've created the world through your word. You've overthrown, you uphold the current world by your word. The judgment is held back by your word. Lord, you do so many things. You made Joshua's way prosperous and successful because he paid attention to your word. This hymn, Trust and Obey, you shed a light and a glory on our way through your word. So Lord, shed a light, I pray. Shine today, I pray. Might there be grace given. And might you help my poor stammering tongue to speak of the great theme of my life somehow, redemption in Christ. Lord, I come back up here again, a one-string violin with one song, Christ, Christ, Christ. And may you cause it to make music again. In Jesus' name, amen. The Lord of the Rings is known to us as a series of movies based on a novel written by J.R. Tolkien and back in the 1930s up into the 40s, about 37 to 49. This is, of course, the time he wrote these. And the first movie in the series, it's not the first in the set in the novel, but the first movie that you can watch is The Fellowship of the Ring. And at the beginning of this movie, it kind of sets the stage so that you understand the whole plot and the storyline of the show. And it covers many, many years. Within like a couple of minutes, it describes the beginning of time when rings were made, and some rings were given to the elves and different people. Some were given to the dwarf lords, and 9 rings were given to kings of men who above all else desired power. And all was well until an evil ring was made by the Dark Lord Sauron. And inscribed on this ring is one ring to rule them all. And that's what he did. He overthrew all the goodness in the earth. And in one particular battle, though, earlier on in this intro into this movie, the ring passed into the hands of men. And when it did, from that moment on, began this story of the deception of this ring, the power of this ring, the seductiveness of this ring. And man after man who had it in his possession, he had the ability to destroy evil, never destroyed it, always got sucked in, always got deceived by its allurement. And it seemed impossible that anybody could resist it. And one notable example is when Gandalf, the good wizard, is trying to exhort Bilbo Baggins, the man from the Hobbit from the Shire, to part with the ring. And he says to him, he says, "Is it so hard?" And he says, "Well, no." And then turning around, caressing the ring, he mumbles under his breath, "Yes." And he starts calling it "my precious." Everybody that had it starts calling it "my precious." Well, 1 John 2:15 is a similar story. Not at the beginning of some fantasy land, but at the beginning of the real creation out there that we live in. All was well until a principle of evil entered in, a power of evil entered in, a thing entered in like this ring. And this thing overturned all that was good and ruined all that was good. And history is full. It fell into the possession of men. History's full of stories. You know stories. Your story has been part of it, falling captive to this thing, this evil, this power. Person after person gets sucked in by it, the pull of it, the power of it. And alongside has been these exhortations to not clutch the ring, to not get sucked in to the ring. John describes this thing simply and soberly as the world. The world entered in to the world. It seems like, as impossible as it was for Bilbo to part with the ring, the command that we have before us this morning seems absolutely impossible to tell sinners, even though saved, do not love the world. It is a hard command to carry out. And yet, John believes that with God all things are possible. John believes we're able to keep it. John believes we're able to not love the world. And so because of that, he sets before us 3 reasons in this text, 3 motivations that he believes are more persuasive and more powerful and have more pull upon the souls of the redeemed, that they're able to pull us out of the black hole of the world. You know what a black hole is? Light can't pass over a black hole. in the universe, out in the galaxy. There's so much matter and so much mass and so much gravitational pull that if a beam of light goes across it, it gets sucked in. And that's what the world is like, this dark black hole that nearly no one seems to be able to resist. So make no mistake about it, what we are told to do today will be miraculous if we are able to do it. It'll be many, many people get funneled down into this thing. And John is telling you to be one of the few that don't. And the way he sets it before us then, it can be divided into two main parts, really. Really simply, you have the exhortation not to love the world in verse 15, the beginning of it. And everything else he says is motivation to not love the world. So it's pretty simple. You got the exhortation to not love the world, verse 15a, or first half of it, and then you got the motivation to not love the world. Now, he spends most of his time, I've titled this Three Reasons Not to Love the World, so I don't want to spend the majority of the time on the exhortation, but we do need to get it right. So let's look first at number one. We'll spend most of our time on point number two of these two. But let's start with one to get the exhortation right. Many have gotten it wrong. And let's just start very simply. You got two phrases here. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. And right off the bat, it's kind of confusing. Are these two things or are these one things? Is there something over here called the world? And then there's something else over here, a second object called the things of the world. And we have fair amount of teachers in this church, and I never learned anything about grammar, so you can learn this, until I began preaching. Other than that, I made D's and C's in English and knew nothing. But there's something called an apposition, an appositional phrase. It sits beside another phrase, and it's talking about the same thing, but it's somehow expanding on it, somehow explaining it or restricting it or saying something about it. For example, I can say, my friend Jeffrey Paul. Well, that second statement, Jeffrey Paul, is not talking about a different friend. Same friend, but I'm now restricting who I'm talking about, further explaining. So John does this, for example, in chapter 3, verse 18. He says, little children, let us not love with word or with tongue. That second statement, he's not telling you two ways not to love, right? One way with your mouth, but the second one, he's getting very specific, saying, when I say don't love with word, I mean your tongue. And when I say love in deed, I mean in truth. So you got two statements there. Or to maybe help you with the one he's going to say in the text, I could say, as some of you know, I do not love sour cream. Neither the texture of it, neither the taste of it, neither the smell of it. So John says, do not love the world, neither any of the things in the world. And he's going to describe them in three ways. So he's just talking about this one thing, this one object of our affection to pull us away from the world. Now, why would he bring this up? I mean, I thought this was a book about tests and assurance. And what is this? Where did this come from? We went from if we say and this and drawing conclusions to, he hasn't mentioned the world at all other than once, pretty much in passing, that Christ died for the whole world. Well, if you remember from the introductory message, what John was dealing with was the seed form of what became known as Gnosticism, which is the word knowledge, gnosis. And so this whole philosophical system of thought, I'm not going to go back into it. You can refer back to that message. But remember, he's dealing with that. And because of that system of thought, because of that wrong doctrine, they were denying things like the incarnation. That's why he begins saying Christ was manifested in the flesh. And also because they thought the material world was evil, the spiritual world was good, they didn't think it really mattered what you did with your body. And thus they become sinful and justified it. Or to say it another way, worldly and justified it. Now bring that up. That's the occasion for John giving this exhortation. We need it today just as much as they needed it then. There are many forms of Christianity that promote worldliness, that justify worldliness. Not in the name of non-Christian, but in the name of Christian. I mean, many of us grew up in the decisionism environment, make your decision, live a worldly life. That's one of them, but we're kind of past that. And many of us, some of us anyway, have been around the prosperity gospel. That's another Christian teaching that promotes worldliness. But there's a newer one today, kind of this emergent church movement that promotes foul language, worldliness. John says, beware of a kind of Christianity that promotes worldliness. No. There is no, he says, do not love the world, nor the things that are in the world. So it's clear that we're being commanded here not to love the world, but it's not clear how that's done. I mean, like I said, the world is like this this black hole, this thing that's sucking you. And I think I missed a Disney analogy last Wednesday, so to plug one in here, if you've seen Toy Story 3, there's the incineration scene where they're sliding down all that stuff. They're going toward that fire. And it's like what I've done, and they start trying to get out, and they realize they can't get out, and you just pretty much throw in the white flag. They all join hands, and they can't do it. And that's the command that John just gave us. Do not love the world. It's like, well, I'd like to do that, but how? And so we'll spend the rest of our time on the motivation not to love the world. The first one is given in the second half of verse 15. If you love the world, it means you're not a Christian. That's one motive to not love the world. Then in verse 16, he explains that and justifies that claim. Then in verse 17, he gives a second reason. The world's passing away. And so you say, where's the third reason? It was the verses we had Wednesday. Verses 12 to 14 make up the third one. And that's the one I want to start with. So the first motivation, if you look at verses 12 to 14, do not love the world because you don't have to love the world. That's the point. If you weren't there, verses 12 and 14, we said we're a break in the test where you've been taking this test. Maybe you've taken an ACT test and you get a break, you get a breather. It was like a breather in the test, a little silent time, a little breather. And the point was, we said, to avoid spiritual introversion in the people of God. To get you sit under these tests, and if you sit under them too long and too heavy, and you become too introverted, and you flip the foundation of salvation upside down, and your performance becomes the foundation, and the work of Christ is a footnote on a page. And it's actually, you start with assurance there and build upon it. And so we had verses 12 to 14, but there's another reason we see this week why John put that in there. And that is, those verses are the foundation for this exhortation. So what we see here is something that we're used to in Paul. that Paul never asks us or commands us or exhorts us to do anything except what's based on what's already been done. And so we see the apostles were in agreement. John taught the same way. And so we're never just simply to react. It's a bold claim. You won't find any command in the whole New Testament given to any Christian that is not based on God already being at work in you. Now, this principle is so... Martin Lloyd-Jones was asked, what do you think the greatest issue in the church is today, back in his day? And he says, people that don't get this. Doctrine and life, the marriage of these two together. And so, for example, just this week we were talking, Justin made a comment, we were talking at the coffee pot, and he's like, when they first came to the church, like for a whole year, he was never told to do anything in the book of Romans. He just, this is what's been done this Sunday. You come back, this is the other thing that's been done, another thing that's been done. And it wasn't until the first time he told us to do anything was think. Think of yourself dead to sin. Well, there's a reason that we've missed this in our day. Why is it so vital? Because of this. What we're asked to do is impossible. The Christian life is impossible. Apart from Christ, we can't bear any fruit. We can't do any of this stuff. We can't greet one another properly. That command to greet one another. We can't greet one another without grace. And this is misunderstood. I'll tell you where this is misunderstood today. I mean, think of how many politicians try to put Christian ethics into the world. I mean, what a fool's errand. I mean, you go up to the lost guy. Do not love the world. Yeah, okay. Put on the Lord Jesus Christ. What a fool's errand. You know? Or you see this in church today among people that ridicule what we're doing right now. Teaching. Doctrine, truth. You don't have time for that. You know, be quick with that. That's people that, and then they wonder why everybody's so dead and lifeless and you have to go through music to do something. Paul and Silas were singing hymns in jail with no harmonica, no guitar, nothing but the Spirit and the truth. And so that's why people are so lifeless and dead. Paul's doctrine was theology on fire, is what it was. Romans 1 to 11 just lit 12 to 16. Colossians 1 to 2 propelled Colossians 3 to 4. Ephesians 1 to 3 was the foundation for leaping of Ephesians 4 to 6. People don't get it today. And you see Christians today, true Christians, discouraged, acting like they can't overcome. You see it in their faces. I do. They're like the toys in that scene. Just, all right, they give up. No use. Guess I'm always going to struggle with this. I guess I'm always going to have this. I guess I'll just slide down the tube. You remember the rest of that scene? When all hope was gone, they've all just kind of gave the defeated look to each other and they armed up, and all of a sudden the light shines and this claw comes down and this outside power lifts them out of the suction in the pool that they were in. And the biblical teaching is you've been chosen by an outside power. You've been laid hold of. Paul in Philippians 3 says, I press on. I dig through the coins, through the trash. How, Paul? That I might lay hold of what has laid hold of me. He had in his mind, he'd been laid hold of. In Colossians 1, he says he labored according to this power that was at work in him. Remember that? Over and over, he's praying. Ephesians 1, he prayed that we might, like Woody, see the light. Like we might see there's an outside power at work in us, that our eyes might be opened. I was telling someone, I've told this story before several times, back whenever I was chopping wood, when I started out just my axe and just, you know, I was going to go Paul Bunyan mode on everything and like do it the real manly way and just chop everything by hand. Yeah, that didn't last very long. But then you're not very encouraged, you know, you just got the axe is just sitting there dead, you know, it takes all energy. And you don't just kind of like challenge, like, you gonna cut wood today? Like, I guess. And you go out, and then I said, someone bought me this big, gigantic power saw, like brand new, plenty of oil, plenty of gas. Like every day I got off at UPS, it was like change clothes, eat some pancakes like Paul Bunyan, and go out and cut. And just like cutting all kind of trees down. And that's the thing. Like so many Christians are not motivated because they don't even have a clue the power that they have access to. And Paul, the first step in sanctification is to think rightly. It's not to do anything. You think rightly first. Get your identity down first before that activity. And so he says that there. Or we said it's like you could put this command this way, and I'll end with this first motivation. Because I don't feel like I've told the story all the way out. We've used it several times, but here's another way to say what John is saying. When it's the difference between D-Day and V-Day. It's been used many times, but perhaps I didn't explain it right. Okay, D-Day was when the Allied forces stormed Normandy Beach. They landed there, it was a bloody battle, but all military analysts say that that was like that chopped the plan off at the root right there. The thing was, there was more battles, but the thing was done after that. Hitler did mount another thing that looked like something, but even that couldn't overcome it. It was over. And what John, and so they had to battle from that point until they finally got the full victory, and that was victory in Europe Day. Well, John is like a military commander saying, do not love the Germans after D-Day. We're living the Christian life after the cross, after the destructive work of the cross has been done. And Satan has been thrown down. And it's just a matter of time. And so when he says, do not love the world, it has a ring of ability to it. It's not just like this thing over me. The first thing he does, John, as a pastor, he lays out 12 to 14. And he says, based on that foundation, you can do this. There's a power at work at you. You can do this. So that's the first great motivation, to not get sucked in by the world's pull, because you can. The second one, in the second half of verse 15, which he explains and justifies in verse 16, is do not love the world, because if you do, then you're not a Christian. See it right there? End of verse 15. If anyone loves the world, what does he say? It's not good to have that said about you. The love of the Father is not in you. That's not a second stage Christianity. It's no Christianity. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. So John just assumes that if you have, this is what he assumes here, if you have the love of the Father in you, it has expelled the love of the world from you. And so there's a popular sermon written based on this verse by a man named Thomas Chalmers, kind of a puritanical type writer back in the day. He calls it the expulsive power of a new affection. And this is what happens in a regeneration when you're born again. And he illustrates it at the end of his sermon. He says, imagine a man on the edge of a world with green pastures. And there's a few good things going on. He sees people and they're having a good time. Kind of a mediocre land. And he says, imagine he's infatuated with that. And he's looking upon that. And all of a sudden out of the water there emerges this new island where he describes people as full of joy, plenty of pleasures, the beauty, the colors are different, everything. He says from that sight, that thing displaces this affection for this thing. The way Paul puts it is, I've counted all things as loss for the sake of the surpassing value of knowing Jesus Christ my Lord. And anybody who's had kids knows this. I see it with Abram all the time. So let's bring it down to the bottom shelf where we all get it. If Abram wants his milk sippy cup and he's looking for it, but he's thirsty and you keep giving him the water sippy cup, he will drink from the water sippy cup. But he may have it in his hand and he's pretty perturbed about it, like, okay, and he'll drink it. But when he sees the milk sippy cup, that, like, this thing is probably going to break. It's boom, throws it down. That's conversion. If you see Christ and you release everything else that had your affections. That's why John can say this. That's the whole treasure in the field. The man sells everything he has that he might buy the field, or he sells everything that he has that he might get the pearl of great price. That's what the new birth is. And so John just says it. He says, if you as a style of life are captivated by the water sippy cup, you haven't seen the milk sippy cup of Christ. You didn't know about the treasure in the field. You haven't seen the pearl of great price. This other island hadn't arose, and that's why you're so infatuated upon this one. So this is an amazing thing. Now, again, this is not perfection. This doesn't mean a Christian can't be pulled momentarily or for a season. But he's speaking of someone who habitually, you know what he's saying, habitually is drawn away by the world. Now, John knows that we're probably wondering at this point a couple of things. One is, what do you mean by the world? Because I thought trees are good and like wives are a good thing and husbands are a good thing. They're part of the world, right? Leaves and animals are good things. And didn't you send your son into the world to love the world? So what do we do with this? And then the second question that he's going to deal with in verse 16 is, how can you be so audacious as to say, if someone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him? So in 16, you get an explanation, what he means by the world, and you get a justification for that statement. So let's look at it. So you see the explanation. He says, for all that is in the world, and he mentions these three things. So he says, this is what I mean when I say the world. Those things that I talked about in verse 15, these are the things. And so let's look at them. Lust of the flesh. What is that? Well, it might surprise you. I don't know if you know this, but lust is not always negative in Scripture. You ever heard Philippians 3? I have a lust to depart and be with Christ. You say, well, they don't translate it, but it's the same word. I have lusted to eat this Passover meal with you. They don't translate it that way, but that's the word. Same word. So the word can have a positive meaning, and you have to look at the context to see, but definitely you're right to bring the connotation of negative to the table, because most of them are. So what would be the lust of the flesh? Well, here he could just mean man in his physicalness, like when he says he could wish himself a curse for the sake of his kinsmen according to the flesh. That's not a negative meaning, just physical. Or he could mean just man in his weakness, like Romans 6:19. He says, I'm speaking this way because of the weakness of your flesh. Or he could mean negatively, man in his sinfulness, like Romans 7:5. While we were in the flesh, the sinful passions were aroused. And here John clearly has the third meaning in mind. He's speaking about sinfully controlled natural desires, either in the wrong direction or with the wrong intensity. For example, you can desire the wrong wife, you can desire the wrong husband, or you're not married at all and you desire a person. That's a sinful lust. Or you can desire something with too great intensity. You can be rebuking everybody for their false doctrine and eating a dozen donuts. That's intense eating. It's overindulgence. It's sin. It's gluttony. Your God is your belly, Paul says. So there's many ways. There's lustful desires in worship. There's out of sync desires. That's why even in religion, Paul is saying, like, no flesh will glory in his sight. And if I have something to boast of in the flesh. So the flesh can manifest itself real dark and gothic-y. And then it can pretty itself up a whole lot like a preacher and manifest itself that way and get pride and get applause that way. So any of these things. So John is not against, and be careful. If you walk away thinking that John is saying just the creation is evil, Paul says it's demonic doctrine in 1 Timothy 4. You ever seen that? He took forbidding marriage, forbidding foods, all that kind of thing. He's not talking about, God said creation is good. He's talking about the twisting of natural desires in the wrong way. What about lust of the eyes? Well, this is the same desire, but with the object held before it. This is Bilbo seeing the ring. Remember that? When he saw the ring, and it activated his desire for it. So the eyes are kind of like the law. They stir up the desire. You wasn't even hungry, and you just ate breakfast, and your stomach is full, and you pass by and smelled some donuts. And there it is. Or you wasn't lusting, and you're driving down the road, and there's a big, huge picture in front of you. Or you were trying to look up something on the internet, and a pop-up, there it is, kindles the desires. Or you're a woman, and you happen to notice the newest kitchen appliance stirs up your desires. David saw Bathsheba, and then he committed adultery. Lot saw Sodom, and then he went and purchased it. Eve saw that the fruit was good. And you remember Satan showed the Lord all the kingdoms of the world. Especially in our day, we're a religious people. They go into a nice stained glass, really looking good and really religious place. It kindles false religious desires, stirs it up. The eyes. The whole tourism industry is based on the lust of the eyes. Again, you're not saying you can't take a trip or anything, but the great majority of these things are motivated by dangling meat before the lion's face. That's what they are. In contrast, think of Psalm 103. I'll set no worthless thing before my eyes. I hate the way of those who fall away. Think of Psalm 119:37. Turn my eyes away from vanity. Think of Romans 13:14. Make no provision for the flesh in regards to its lust. So I've said before, say again, it'd be better to enter life without an iPhone than to go to hell with an iPhone. It'd be better to go to heaven without a computer than to go to hell with a computer. and the eyes, the images. I mean, it's an amazing thing in our day. The third one he mentions here is the boastful pride of life. Now, this was interesting to me. Life does not, it's not this generic thing. There's another word for life that we normally have. This is a unique one. It's bios, and we get biography from it. We get that word biography from it. Let me give you some places it's used that will shock you. How about 1 John 3:17? But whoever has the world's goods, or if I could show you the link, livelihood. That word goods is the word life, the same that's used in 2:16. Another place it comes up is in the story of the prodigal son. Remember, he says, divide and give me your wealth. It's translated wealth there. Livelihood. And then the older son says, you squandered. He squandered all your wealth, your livelihood. That lady that put the coin in, Jesus said in Luke 21:4, she put in all she had to live on, her living money. That's the life that John has in mind. So it refers to livelihood. Or we kind of talk this way still. We'll say, like, you can make a good living doing that. So we use life that way. And by which we mean ability to acquire things, stuff, possessions. Now, what would be the meaning of this here? Because we know this guy in 1 John 3:17 has the world's goods. It's not having them that's wrong, right? So what is this about life? Well, it's the boastful pride of life. In other words, making a living for the sake of boasting in it. James uses this word about the guy, we will go here and there and buy and sell and make a profit. He says, you boast in your arrogance. Same word there for boasting. There's an illustration of this in the Old Testament at the very beginning of the book of Esther, when King Ahasuerus calls this banquet, and it says there that he displayed all his royal possessions, and everybody ate on nice couches, and ivory was everywhere, and marble, and drank out of gold vessels. I mean, like, he didn't keep his funds hidden away in the vault, in the crusty steel vault of the bank. In other words, his whole motive for having it was to display it. And you see this today. People get $1 million and they go buy something big. They just can't stand that people don't know that they have $1 million. They have to display it. Set it out there before people. And thus they reveal their whole motive of getting it. To boast in it. To glory in it. Or someone gets multi-$1 million and then they go build a multi-$1 million home. And there was really no need. They were fine. It's just to display. It's, you know, dressing to impress. Just this idea of just this, want people to think I'm somebody and do it some way. I got the ability right here, and it kills fallen man to have a treasure of riches and nobody to know it. Heals him. You got to let it know. You got to display it. If you want an image for the boastful pride of life, watch the next Republican election. And just look at Donald Trump as an example of the boastful pride of life. He sounds like Nebuchadnezzar or somebody, you know, my hand has done all these things. Just full of the boastful pride of life. So for this person, it's not enough to keep up with the Joneses. You have to surpass the Joneses and become the Joneses that everybody else is trying to keep up with. That's the goal. So again, it's not having wealth that's a sin. It's acquiring it for the purpose of boasting, for the purpose of displaying it. Now that's the explanation of what he means by the world. What about the justification of this statement he made? So I'm taking it as is. I could try to pretty the sermon up, but I'm just flowing with John as is. He made a statement. He explained something. Now he wants to come back and justify his statement, if you love the world, the love of the Father is not in you. And he says it at the end of verse 16. All this stuff, these three things, is from the world, is not from the Father, but is from the world. This is like where Christ said, you cannot serve God and money. They're opposites. They're antagonistic toward one another. They don't fit together. They're like trying to put two opposite sides of a magnet together. They don't go together. So what is James? He says, friendship with the world is enmity with God. So what does he mean by world then? The word is cosmos, the word world, and it means order and arrangement. We get cosmetics from it. And so when you women are putting makeup on your face, you're putting your face in order, in a certain arrangement. So what you, Peter actually uses it that way in 1 Peter 3, their arrangement. He called it's world there. It's contrasted with chaos, which means disorder. So it just means order in and of itself. You get cosmology from it. The cosmos, the order, there's gravity, there's principles, there's laws, there's physics. So what do you mean, John, the order? What order is anti-God? Well, it's like this. It's not the world in itself, but the way it's currently arranged. The way it's currently being used. It's not the idea of a husband itself, but the way that husbands now act. It's not the idea of a mother, but the way that mothers act in this fallen world. It's not the idea of a boss, but the way that bosses act. And so it's like on the movie Gladiator, the good emperor dies and you get an evil, wicked emperor running things. It's not the office that's wrong. It's the new order of the office, the new way, the new scheme, the new setup, the new processes, the way that it's being used in a twisted way. Instead of serving people, now we're dominating people and killing people. And so that's what John means by the world. There's this system, and in John, in the Gospel of John, he talks about a ruler of this world. Y'all know I'm not against movies, but just let me throw this out here for the sake of the parents' discernment. Do you know on Finding Nemo, Dory mentions evolution when she's swimming? Do you know why she mentions it? Because the world lies in the power of the evil one. That's why. By and large, Hollywood does not produce movies that help your Christian growth. Again, am I saying don't watch them? No. But it's just sort of like heads up, discernment. It's there. It's just really just to show the reality that it's there. There's something. Why does every one of them have to have something? Why? Because there is a system. There is a scheme. The world has a boss. And it's not Donald Trump. So here's the conclusion then. John is not saying creation is evil. He's not saying natural desires are evil. He's not saying possessions are inherently evil. He's not saying we ought not love the world and send ourselves, just like he sent his son, into the world. He's saying we're to love the world with a love of redemption, but not with the love of participation. That's the difference between John 3:16 and 1 John 2:15. So anyway, that's his explanation for his second one. So we have the final motivation in verse 17. Don't love the world, because it's passing away. He says, the world is passing away and also its lusts, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. I don't have to spend too much time here. It seems like we've seen it a lot. We saw this in Romans 13. The night is almost gone. The day is at hand. This is the view of the New Testament, that this old creation is being pushed out. The new one has dawned. It's on its way in. And so we've illustrated it several ways. We said it's like the award ceremony, where this curtain over here is closing and the other one over here is opening. In terms of eschatology, in terms of end times, John is saying this world is closing. God has set in motion the closing of the curtain. Don't invest in that. Or we've compared it to like the seasons right now. Like summer is clearly on its way out. Winter is clearly on its way in. You don't go out and spend $700 on clothing for summertime right now. It's on its way out. People are wearing their boots again, and the women are every chance they get. It's a cold morning. I get to wear my scarf and my hat and my boots. And so what we do in Louisiana, you know, it's 50 degrees and you got the snow jacket on. But nobody is buying swimwear. Nobody is buying muscle shirts and short sleeves and shorts. Sandals are well stocked in the stores right now. We've illustrated it with the hotel. Nobody stays in a hotel and rearranges the hotel because they're just there temporarily. Think of the Titanic. Like I'm always hunting for illustrations. But I was looking at the Titanic, and there are some people in that movie that are playing their violin. Just seen that? While it's going down, they're just playing. And that's the picture of some people. Imagine someone, the ship is turning. It's passing away. And someone's dusting the mantle in there or something. This world is passing away, John is saying. Don't be overly preoccupied with it. The power went out this morning. I had to take a shower, and I knew that the hot water was passing away. So I didn't make plans to stay in there very long. I didn't set up something to listen to and invest too much in it, because I knew it was passing away. First Corinthians 7:31, the world, form of this world is passing away. 1 John 2:8, the darkness is passing away. You know what helped me about this? I got this when we were in Romans 13. Think of this. On the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Edmund, you know how the Wicked Witch got him? He liked the sweets. And do you remember this one scene where they took it and threw it up against the tree and it just turned into powder? It was like it was nothing. There was no, it was deceit. There was nothing to it. How many people are mesmerized by the body, whether male or female? Do you know it's going to be powder very soon? Do you know how foolish to be mesmerized by things? They're like a shadow. They're going to perish. Peter says they're going to melt. And then after he says it, he says, what sort of people ought we be then in light of it? This was a motive in New Testament Christianity. So, put it this way. This is a thought I've always had. It's amazing. All the things you're working to accumulate right now, you're spending all your days to accumulate, it's going to take somebody about one day to give it away in a garage sale. And you're just amassing it and amassing it and amassing it. Paying all kind of money. Yeah. Okay, I'll take $1.50. And it's just gone to whoever. In contrast, John says, make the will of God your career as a style of life. Do the will of God, because then you'll remain forever. So here's the conclusion of the whole thing. There's a great seductive power that has ruined everything, the world that you and I were born into. And it's sucking at us. And we're told here not to get sucked in by it. Don't love the world. And we're told, first of all, you don't have to. You can resist it. We're told, second of all, if you don't, it means you're not a Christian. You've never been born again. So you don't want to be that guy. And the third is, it's passing away. Don't be like Edmund, clinging for what has no substance, what is not eternal. And I thought of a story that came to my mind this morning as I close this out that I thought well illustrated the kind of life that this text is meant to create in us. And it's the life of Martin Lloyd-Jones. Martin Lloyd-Jones got throat cancer at the end of his life and had to stop preaching. And he had a doctor would come by. He was bedridden. The doctor would come by checking on him. It lasted a while. It took him about 10 years to die. But toward the end, as he was fighting, his voice got really, really shallow. You know, he couldn't hardly speak. And the doctor one day was coming by checking on him and told him it makes him, he feels bad to see him so sad. And the biographer writes that was barely able to talk. He says, not sad, not sad. And then like a few days later, as he's really getting bad about to die, his daughter was in the room with him. And he had totally lost his voice by this point. And she was sitting in the room with him and she heard, like, tapping on his Bible. And Martin Lloyd-Jones had opened his Bible. He couldn't speak, but he had opened his Bible and he was tapping. He wanted his daughter to read a verse to him. This was the verse. Therefore, we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. And here's why. We look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. So John says, you can live the Christian life blind. Fanny Crosby did, because we look not at the things which are seen. And what better song could I think of for us to sing as our closing song before the fellowship meal than I'd rather have Jesus? It even uses the word world in there. So we're going to sing that. And after we sing, I'll get Trevor to pray for us.